Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Getting to Certification by Transforming Your SDLC. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, here with today's speakers, David Halk and Andre Madan of Parasoft. I'd like to start by more formally introducing our speakers, starting with David Halk, who is the Director of Embedded Sales at Parasoft. David has experience in sales, marketing, and software development, with the majority of his career being spent working with and for companies focused on embedded systems. After receiving his bachelor's in computer science, David served as an information systems officer in the United States Air Force. As a captain, he ran the computer operations floor for the B-2 CTF at Edwards Air Force Base and developed software for the flight test management system. As a commercial software engineer, David worked on several government programs and played an important role in the Software Technology for Adaptable Reliable Systems, or STARS, project. Prior to Parasoft, David has led teams at Wind River, Rational, and Gramatech that focused on improving the software development lifecycle for companies ranging from Fortune 500s to small startups. He has presented at numerous software conferences, workshops, and trade shows throughout his career, including keynote addresses to more than 3,000 attendees, as well as at presentations throughout Europe and Asia. Our second presenter today is Andre Madan, who is a senior solutions architect at Parasoft. Andre is a software testing professional who focuses on tools and methodologies, and in his current role, he works with customers to identify technical and business best practices for efficient testing of heterogeneous applications. Andre is passionate about testing approaches that satisfy critical quality expectations, and prior to joining Parasoft, he spent 10 years at Medtronic developing embedded systems and test environments for life-critical implantable products. There, he led various teams that influenced all phases of the SDLC. Andre has presented on software testing topics at such conferences as DevNexus, Star East, Quest, GTS, ASTQB, and others. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in computer science from Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Now on to some brief housekeeping items before we get to the meat of the presentation. Today's schedule consists of approximately 45 minutes in presentation, leaving about 15 minutes for Q&A at the end of the hour. Your viewing console consists of a set of windows that you can close, open, move, resize, and maximize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenters in the presenter window, biography in the speaker bio window, presentation slides in the slides window, and a Q&A window that enables you to ask questions during the event. When using the Q&A window, simply type your question into the Ask a Question text box, then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event, and we'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A session. If you have any tech support questions, you can submit those as well, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist. Another important item of note is the set of 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking the icon at the far left will reset your viewing area to the default configuration. The rest of the icons will open or close a corresponding window. You can hover your mouse over each icon to show what it controls, and of these, probably the most important is the handout icon, which is third from the right. This opens the handout window with the presenter's slides in PDF format, so you can download and follow along with a hard copy or print off for future reference. The final note before we begin is that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. So at this point, we can get started, and I'll hand it off to David Halk of Parasoft. David, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Brandon. Right as you were transitioning to me, my console stopped. I am restarting. Here we go. All right. Listen, thank you. I apologize for that delay. I'm not sure what happened. Hopefully that will be the first and last drop of this session. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you all for taking the time to be with us today. This is the third in a 3-part series that Andre and I have been doing focused on safety certification. And so today we're going to be talking about getting to certification and transforming the embedded SDLC. Along that way, we're going to be talking about briefly the certification challenges for safety critical systems. We are then going to talk a little bit about what we talked about in sessions 1 and sessions 2, kind of refreshing where we are today with MISRA and ISO 26262 according to this conversation. And then we're going to move into some of the net new content, talking about the certification for highly critical systems, and in particular, a key aspect which is required for those which have the utmost safety certification, that is the qualification of the tools themselves. We'll then move on and talk a little bit about what we can do to improve the software development lifecycle by looking at the workflow and being smart about what we can do, how we choose to perform our work, by removing some of the tedious activities, and most importantly, focusing on the activities which will provide the most value. We do this with a process intelligence engine on our end, and it basically provides analytics that helps us guide to better choices in software development. While this section on improving the SDLC is certainly relevant to safety certification, it is by no means exclusive to it, and it would apply to any software development project, whether that is for safety certification or not, and really whether or not that is an embedded project. We'll talk about Parasoft and a few of the things that we can do moving forward, and as a conclusion to this three-part series, we will have a promotion to be offered to any of the folks that have attended one or two or three parts of this series. So with that, let's begin. I have used this slide in each of these sessions, and I don't intend to spend too much time on it, but it is evident to anyone that's following the industry that software is becoming the key critical component into automotive vehicle safety moving forward. We are now at the age where we are not only having more software in our vehicles, but that software is creeping ever and ever closer to the steering wheel. And by that, when software takes control, I think we all have some reservations about what might happen in those types of circumstances. And, of course, we, as the software engineering community, owe our best due diligence to ensure that our systems are safe, and we go the extra effort to ensure that our software performs precisely as expected. That journey is what we're talking about today. That journey has a couple of implications. One, it means we're going to have to do more work. And two, it's going to cost us in both time and various tools and processes that we have to employ. So in September, we had a session talking about MISR 2012 and the compliance in a safety critical system. And during that session, we talked about a few things. One is that MISR has been moving forward. It has been updated last year, actually, with a compliance guidance from the MISR community. And that helped to highlight MISR is not just a set of rules that are applied to statically analyzed code, but it is more a relationship between the vendor and the client. And that relationship has to be agreed upon and set out in advance so that we know at the end of what we do for a MISR compliance software development effort is in accordance to the expectations of the client that's going to receive it. So with that, not only are the rules that is specified by MISR, not only those rules need to be applied, but we have to understand how they'll be applied, and in many cases, when they are applied and they do not work, they have a violation, how we mitigate that. And so our enforcement plan, the recategorization plan, which is basically an agreement as to the importance of a particular rule, whether or not that rule is one required, which is really not something you change, or optional or mandatory, can be documented in that. And that is done for any project that's using MISR for compliance. In no cases, are MISR rules applied in force. There really isn't a practical application for an embedded software development effort where MISR is taken in its entirety. There is always adaptation. And so when deviations do occur, we have to document them, and we have to, of course, then provide our complete summary to the project. Parasoft can help do all of these things. These projects that have to have these plans and reports submitted, we can help generate them from our tools, all the things that are done through the automation of these rules and the selection of these rules and the mitigation to these rules can be captured through our system. We did talk about MISRA 2012, which applies to C, which is the predominant language that's used in most embedded systems. But there's also MISRA 2008, which is C++. And that has had updates as well. We are now fully compliant with MISRA 2012 and 2008, along with the security updates that came with MISRA 2016. One of the things that we do, as we discussed during that session, is to help you understand where you are in terms of compliance. So not only do we apply the rules and allow you to tailor them to the things that are needed to be done for your project, but we allow you to look at the visibility of what's happening along your compliance, and so that various stakeholders, whether you're a practitioner who's responsible for some subset of the code that has to deal with and address any raised violation according to MISRA, or whether you're a project manager who might come in and take a look, you know, on a daily or perhaps weekly basis and need to know how the team is progressing, how far are they along as far as whether or not they're compliant, and where, if they're not compliant, the focus of the effort is. So this kind of reporting is important to MISRA, as we discussed. So that's a quick recap of the things that we discussed during that first session. About a month ago, we had a follow-on session talking about ISO 26262, and we spoke about this in particular for automotive safety. One of the things that we discussed was the fact that this is very important, of course, to high-risk systems, and when it comes to 26262, those are rated as far as an ASIL rating, with using letters where A being the least riskful and D being the highest risk. You can imagine, as we discussed a moment ago, as the software approaches the steering wheel, it becomes far more advantageous to apply the highest set of safety standards to the software that's actually going to take control of the vehicle. So in doing that, there are tools that need to be used, there are processes that need to be put in place, and there is, quite frankly, a higher level of skill set to certify that software. In general, the rule of thumb is as you move up from one ASIL level to the next, you're going to incur an order of magnitude increase in cost. So it's important that we understand how these standards are applied. It's important that we understand what the impact is to our process, and it's important that we look at how can we help to reduce our own effort and improve our focus on these safety certification standards, whether that's through our own education or that's through tools that can help us to remove some of the tedium that's required in these steps. To that point, remember that we discussed that 26262 itself is not a process, but it's a set of activities. And in part six, we look at some of those activities that relate directly to the software development. And remember that for us, in the impact that we can have at Parasoft with our tooling to improve your safety certification in your software development environment, we can do that through the coding activities, the unit testing activities, and, of course, the integration testing. We do that specifically by providing code coverage for the tests that are run, by supporting on-target execution of those tests, by supporting unit test stubbing and, you know, giving the summary of the visibility to the stakeholders so we know that where we are, what code has been covered, what has not been covered, the tests that have been run, whether they have passed or failed. We also have to, and we're going to talk about this a lot more today, is that they have to be qualifiable for the intended use. If you're going to go through a process like 26262, you must ensure that the tools that you're using are able to find the things that process is dictating. So they have to be qualifiable. Tracing back to requirements, and then finally static code analysis, as we discussed a moment ago with MISRA. So these are areas that we can help within the context of 26262. That gets us to the topic that we want to address today, one of them. The first topic being tool qualification. And here you can see right from the standard that what you have to be able to do to qualify a tool is to show that there is evidence that the tool is suitable for use when you're developing a safety-related item or element, and that confidence can be achieved by providing correct execution of the activities and the tasks required. Simply stated, what this means is if you're going to go through a process with as much rigor as we're talking about for this type of safety certification, not only do you have to do that for your software, but if you're using tools to help you automate any portion of that or are providing data to the reports that you submit for that certification process, you have to validate that the tools themselves are doing what they are designed to do. So, you know, net sum, if you're going to use any tool, whether that's open source, whether that's homegrown, whether that's a commercial off-the-shelf tool, you're going to have to go through that qualification process when you look at the higher levels of ASIL. We'll talk about more about that in just a moment, but it's important to understand when you're making that selection. This is a key part to safety certification, and if you don't make these decisions with knowledge in advance, it could be very costly as you move forward. So with that, Andre and I have had fun. More fun for Andre than for me, but it's still fun. And we wanted to be able to give you a way in which to consume some of the information that we want to present in a way which has a little bit of humor and a little bit of a practical approach, actually, to understanding how these tools are used. In some cases in webcasts like this, you might see a demo that's live, that's clicking through the tool and talking about it, a lot of options and menus and going through details. We chose not to do that. I hope that you can appreciate why. And as a consumer, you can understand the discussion at the level of what we're trying to accomplish when we use these tools in the context of a process like safety certification. So with that, I am typically the pointy-headed manager, and Andre is the seasoned and somewhat sarcastic software development engineer. And so with that, we'll step into role here for a moment, and we'll come back to our project. So we've had this journey where we've been understanding what is MISRA and how to apply it and what the complexities were for our teams and our tools. And we've also done the same thing with unit testing, specifically related to 26262. And so I, as the manager, I'm now getting to the point where I'm being convinced that maybe some of this and some of Parasoft's technology is actually going to save us time, even though I have to spend money, which I am generally not apt to do. I like free stuff, as we all do. But we've been making the case, and we're now getting to the point where we understand that there is great automation, and we can remove some of the tedium and improve our effectiveness by using the tools. So we jump into role, and I am now back into my project, and I'm working with Andre. And Andre, I'm going to ask you now, because I think I do understand that some of this software is going to help us, but we have this open question that comes from MISRA, that comes from 26262 about the qualification of the tool. And I'm not sure how are we even going to enter into this certification process, and what's it going to mean for us? And is it going to cost me money, Andre?
Yeah, okay. So you have a lot of questions, Dave. Well, I got good news and bad news for you, Dave. First of all, the good news is that you're starting to ask the right questions at the right time. And most people I've seen, they are addressing the topic of full qualification towards the end of the project when there is not enough resources to address it and not enough time. And moreover, the right resources who know the domain of how the tool is used, they already moved on to a different project, and then you're scrambling for resources and time to get yourself in compliance. So the good news is over. The bad news is that you must have completely forgotten everything we've talked on the previous seminar with you. So with that, I'd like to refresh your old manager memory. What we've talked about last time, this is the slide from the last seminar with that we've done, that was talking about just giving you a high level of the framework of the tool qualification. Well, today I'd like to give you a little bit more flavor and details about how it's actually done and what Parasoft provides as a framework and as a tool to do that tool qualification. So that's, again, that's a slide from the last time. What it basically outlines are multiple things. So there's this TCL, basically tool confidence level, that you need to know. You look at how the tool is being used in your process and by analyzing the features and analyzing the risk of the tool not performing what it's supposed to do and what would be the risk to the actual end user of your product, then you figure out what is your tool confidence level, how confident you are that the tool can find a risky or relatively high severity issue. So then you figure out the TCL2 or TCL3. We, in our product, Dave, we are using the tool from Parcell, which is classified as TCL3. Now you go down this line here, and then you figure out that there's something that's highlighted. So you like colors, Dave. So what is highlighted? Yeah. I know. So when I was preparing the slides, I was like, I need to put more colors, right? So and there's errors. So you see that here, the line 1C states that in some cases you need to do validation of the software tool, and in some cases you don't. Well, in our cases, we're going to dive into the details of how we're doing the software the validation of a software tool, because you see that for level D, for ASIL level D, and if you are if you're using the tool with a TCL3, then you auto validate your tool. So now let's talk about how it's done. We have a qualification kit. Parcell provides a qualification kit that was developed in conjunction with the company Validas. And that qualification kit is just a separate software piece, right, that's running on your desktop, and it helps you to perform your tool qualification easier. It provides you the framework, the components that are necessary for you to set up what you're qualifying for, what standard. In our case, it's ISO 26262, but you can also, there's a choice there to qualify the tool for a different standard, like ADL 178B. So, but in the context of this, in the context of this conversation, we'll just be talking about ISO 26262. So there are many components. We're not going to dive into every one of them. But what's important to highlight there is there are templates for the documents here. So the TCR stands for tool classification report. So it tells us how we are classifying the tool. Then there is a TQP, which is a tool qualification plan. It tells it, the template, it tells you, okay, what are we going to do about it and what activities are being planned to be performed, right? And then there is a TQR, which is the tool qualification report, which states, okay, according to our plan, we've completed all of the necessary activities. And then there is a TSM, which is a tool safety manual, that tells you, okay, that's the manual, that's how to use the tool. All right, so there are other components that are inputs into the process. Some of them are, let's say, tasks that are necessary to be performed for the tool. So one of the examples of the tasks would be, let's say, if you're running a MISRA check, and you ran all of your MISRA checks against your project, and you didn't find any violations. Well, the tool validation answers the question to you, is there a way for you to even have a violation using that tool? Will the tool trigger the violation, or will the tool find the problem if the problem would exist? So that's a very important quality of the validation process. It gives you the confidence that the tool is working properly in the context of your compiler, of your build environment, of your use cases. Speaking of the use cases, so before we dive into the use cases and the tool qualifier role here, there are various, so in a good implementation of the tool, there are various roles that are important to realize. In most of the organizations, a lot of those roles are joint, and then they potentially can be performed by one person or two or three. But it's important to recognize that if you want to use the tool effectively, not every role is basically equal. So, for example, here without spending too much time here, but the process owner role is the person who would say, okay, this has to be done. We want to use the tool in this fashion. While the tool owner basically outlines, okay, I need to install it in this server. There's this license. Here's the manual. So it basically, the analogy here is like a wife and a husband. My wife tells me, okay, you need to basically resurface the deck. And then I find the materials, I go to Menards, and I actually do the work. So she is, in this case, the process owner. Something has to be done, and how, the color and everything. And then I'm the tool owner. The tool qualifier is something I really want to highlight here, is the person who qualifies the tool, runs, uses the framework, uses or writes the tasks or uses the tasks that are provided by the vendor. In this case, we're going to talk about the tool qualifier in more detail. So the tool qualifier takes that qualification kit and runs through the wizard. And the wizard is very self-explanatory. Like, for example, if you are using just the MISRA C compliance static analysis features, you don't really care about, let's say, application monitoring features. You don't care about some of the unit testing features. So you don't need to qualify those features, even though, as you already know, they are part of our tool. So in this, you first have to determine the scope. What are you qualifying? Because you don't want to waste your time qualifying the entire tool. Then once the scope is defined, there are other things that you set, like, for example, a list of known issues of the tool. You need to import that. You need to figure out what are the errors, potential errors. You need to map your resolutions for those errors. So there's a framework and the workflow that we provide to address all of those things. So this view just tells, okay, now you've set everything up. Now you have to go through those steps and set up what they are. So we're doing all of that to save us time at the end. And the time savings comes from the fact that there are lots of documents, there's lots of documentation that is being automatically generated based on a model, based on test results, based on certain understanding of how the standard should be interpreted. And then we're just generating those reports for you. And the good thing is, if your requirements throughout the project change, you don't need to rewrite your docs, right? You just need to either update the model or add the features, rerun the tool qualification process, rerun the tests, re-execute the manual tests, and the reports. The framework gives you the way to generate those reports, regenerate those reports automatically. So, all right, as a summary, so what do we provide? We provide the framework and the qualification kit that gives you ability to identify your use cases. There's a framework to set those use cases in the tool. And then we give you a bundle of test cases that you can re-execute with your compiler on your machine within your operating environment, so to speak. And then gives you the report and documents that you need to present to the to either the audit or internal audit or external audit bodies. So that's the qualification kit for us.
Andre, thank you. I'm not going to admit whether or not I forgot some of those things, but now that we've been refreshed, I think I get it. So you're saying that these things will be created for us. These documents that we need for the safety certification process are going to be created.
Yes. That's where you're saving a lot of time. Because the last thing you want, Dave, is to have your developers and engineers start writing the documentation. Well, they still have to write some documentation, but it's boring, right? And you can lose a lot of talent if you tell people, okay, now you're doing the tool qual, which means, like, for the next 3 months, you ought to spend updating the doc and maintaining it.
So, okay, all right.
Not a good idea.
All right. So if we think about this then, and we've covered a lot of ground, and we have the things that we need to do for the safety certification and validation, which cover a lot of complex standards, MISRA and 26262, and then tracking all these things and documenting our qualification of the tools that we use. I, as a manager, remember that somehow we actually have to develop software that is intended for use, which gives us our competitive advantage in the market. In general, you know, my concern is we actually have to create software which is useful and effective and innovative. And it sounds to me like we have to track a whole lot of other things just to be playing into this safety certification. How can we possibly manage all these things? You know, I, as you know, Andre, I'm a very good juggler. And I think of things as to how many balls I have to keep in the air. And I'm concerned right now that I'm going to have too many.
Yeah.
What are we going to do?
And they are colorful. And they're colorful. Remember that day. So you want to know which balls to drop, right? And what will be the color.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, so I'll tell you how people actually do that in real life, because I've seen that and been working in those environments. Here's how people do that. They set up meetings. They invite various stakeholders. They invite engineers to the meetings. And then they just talk through the all of the data points. They bring a whole bunch of spreadsheets to the meeting. They then have a very heated, sometimes, opinion exchange of what data point is more important or less important. If they run out of time, all they do is reschedule the meeting. So at the end of the day, throughout that cycling of the meetings, there's probably a leader who emerges, and that leader makes decisions based on some of the subjective characteristics and then some of the objective data points. And that's very, like, unpredictable because of that person who can make the decision at the end of the day. Are we compliant or not? He's, let's say, on vacations, or he was not presented with all of the right data points. Then you can get an unpredictable result, or your, let's just say, data analysis and the workflow can take a lot of months, and I've seen that happen. So you're probably wondering, like, okay, Andre, nice. I have the solution. Go to the meetings and spend time there, which is nice for the manager, right? That's all they do. But
there's donuts at the meetings, right, Andre?
Oh, that's right. Well, if you bring them, yeah. I'm not bringing any donuts.
Uh-huh.
You need to lure the engineers into the meeting. So, and pizza, by the way. Yeah. So, how would we approach that problem? And before we start talking about the real kind of solution that is pertinent to the safety critical space, I'd like to take a step back and talk about how that problem has been solved by some of the industry leaders, like, for example, Google Maps, right? They have the same challenge, right? They have the data point, different data points. They have static data points, which don't change often. It's the road data, the maps, the speed limits. And they also have the dynamic data that changes every second. It's traffic conditions, road constructions, accidents, and whatnot. So if they would apply the same workflow as I described, you know, sit at the meetings, look at all the data points, and just did kind of come up with an optimal route, you wouldn't get anywhere in your car. You need the immediate response from Google Maps. You push the button, you know exactly where to go immediately, so you don't waste your time. Same idea can be applied in software development life cycle. So let's talk about that. There are various data points that we talked with you about, right? We talked about the static analysis violations. We talked about the code coverage. We talked about the unit testing. What we kind of implied that we talked about is the metrics, like the complexity of the code. So all of those data points can actually be aggregated. And then what can we do with that aggregation of that data? That's a good question. So what today I will tell you, Dave, a few things that we can do today. So, for example, one of the examples here is we can analyze the code that has been changed between, let's say, build 1 and build 2, and we can tell you a few things about that change. Like, has that change been tested correctly? Has the complexity increased? Or what is the risk of that change given a lot of factors like static analysis, unit test failures, lack of code coverage, relative cyclomatic complexity of the code. So we can basically analyze those data points together and give you a good insight into what's risky and what's not. There are a lot of other things that we'll dive into. This impact of change is really important. Because being compliant is one thing. Compliance is binary. You're either compliant or not. What's important in a software development lifecycle, if you change something, what is the impact of that change? That's what we are providing here. Then there are other things that this platform that we're going to dive into can do for us. Like, for example, can trigger external processes, can, let's say, open, like we're using Jira internally, right? So I can set the system up so it automatically opens the ticket in Jira if certain policies are not met. So I can address it right away. Again, you don't need to sit in meetings to determine if you need to open a ticket or not. The system will automatically enforce that workflow and create tickets for you, so the engineers are more productive. They don't have to come to your meetings, even though they might want to eat pizza, so they might still want to come. All right. More details. That's a pretty busy slide, but let's digest what we're seeing here. On the left here, we're seeing the inputs. The inputs to the system can be either coming from static analysis, the miser violations, or testing and coverage, like how we executed the unit tests, potentially on the target or in the host, combining the code coverage between various components. Maybe it's the unit testing, integration testing, or manual testing, so we can feed that data in as a raw data. And then we're actually using a few open source tools in-house, so the open source tools are welcomed, and then we can import the data from those tools as raw observations into the development testing platform. And then we would analyze the data. Think of it as like intelligent callback. Once the data is in, we would execute a series of analytics engines or processing slices. We call them pie slices. And then they would then analyze that data and give you results. So one of the results may be, okay, displaying the data in a dashboard. You've seen that we built, you showed in one of the slides that you have the MISRA compliance dashboard. That compliance dashboard is actually created by analyzing the data with respect to the MISRA domain. And we have other domains that we support. So one of the things that you see here actually is interesting is you can push the data to the desktop IDE. So the desktop, the IDE is what the developers are using on a day-to-day basis. So if you really want to speed up or make developers more productive, you need to speak their language. You need to display the data in the environment that is convenient to them. You don't want to drag them into some other system and make them learn it and whatnot. So if we can then prioritize the tasks and push those tasks down into the IDE level, that would be ideal because the developers, they don't have to go to those meetings to understand what they need to do. They can get that directly into the IDE, and in, I don't know, 10 o'clock when they show up to the office, they can be productive right away. This is just one of the dashboards that I talked about, how we can display the data for compliance for different domains. So this domain is a security domain. All of the violations here, they're found and displayed with respect to CWE compliance. What's important here is that you can see some of the colors, Dave. See the colors? That's that's really telling you where you have to focus on your efforts.
I appreciate that, Andre. I've woken up again.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad you did, because that's really the point of this of the system there, to make you as a manager productive in highlighting where the bottlenecks are, where you need to focus, where you need to maybe have a meeting with the people who develop a more complex, more risky component, but then you're actually making your job a lot more streamlined. You're focusing on dragging the people in the meeting who actually matter, who are important. You know, I've been sitting in some of the meetings where it's like 25 people in the meeting, and only two or three of those guys or girls actually matter. The rest of them are wasting their time. So focusing on the domain and focusing on highlighting the bottleneck, the focusing on highlighting the pieces that are not compliant and giving you insight into those non-compliant pieces with a quick and easy dashboard technology will reduce the effort that is spent on a project by dragging the people, by talking to the people who matter. Okay, so one of the things that we are going to dive into right now are the things we can do with the data. So it's just a list. I know it's a lot to read. So let's not read, let's talk about the risk of change. So, for example, we have, let's just say that we've got a code base that has 100 files, and we have 2,000 tests. And then we changed out of those 100 files, let's say we've changed 10 of those files. Well, do we need to rerun all of those 2,000 tests? Do we need to, which ones of those are going to be getting the coverage, right, of those files. So the change-based testing, the first bullet point here, will give us the answer. Given the code change, what is the minimal subset of tests that needed to be retested? So, Dave, would you like to have a system that will reduce the amount of retests you do on every single incremental build by, let's say, percentage points?
It sounds like it would save time and money. I'd say yes.
Yeah, so it's a no-brainer. You don't need to retest everything on every single increment. But the problem is people don't know what to retest. So, again, they sit in meetings, they send emails. We probably affected, like, those five features. So why don't we just rerun all the tasks? So that's a normal kind of a communication workflow between the people. The change code coverage, so the second bullet point talks about the code that has been modified but hasn't been covered with any tests or has not been adequately covered. So let's say I inserted five lines of code somewhere, and I checked it in, and I went home. That analysis can tell you, as a manager or as a lead, have I updated my unit test? Have I rerun my integration or functional test to make sure that my code that they just updated is adequately tested. So, and there are a few other analytic pieces that we can do, but let's just focus on the first two bullet points there and look at how it actually looks in real life. We already know what triggers the analysis is the data, the raw data, being published into the system. Now we render that data, we analyze the data, and on that dashboard, you see that there are 10 changes between the build one and build two, and there are two things we can tell you. At least we are highlighting the two things in this presentation. The first one is that 54.8 number. It is the percentage of code that hasn't been tested between the two builds, and we do it by the line number. So you can dive into that and figure out what code hasn't been tested and act accordingly. Really quickly, you can fill in the gaps. And the second point here is that, see that gray area? It's called the number of tasks that needed to be retested. So here we can understand what are the tasks that needed to be rerun given the code change. Okay, so you can dive into that and have a list of tests and and which will show you which tasks have to be re-executed. You can actually integrate it with your CI tool and then work from there. All right, so as a summary, the workflow and analytics engine that we have called Extension Designer can help us going beyond the compliance. It can help us on a day-to-day journey of developing a safety-critical application by focusing on creating custom policies. Let's say if we have something above and beyond ISRA, we can use the framework that PERSOFT provides and then create our own policies and then integrate the policy compliance framework with our CI infrastructure. Then we can simplify complex workflows, for example, opening the ticket in Jira. Well, that can be automated based on some criteria. And the third, the most important thing is managing the visibility and giving you the visibility of change. So what changed? What was affected? What was not tested? What is the relative risk of change? So, Dave, I think that will help you juggle your balls in the air very effectively.
Thank you, Andre. I fully appreciate it. Sounds like what you're doing is, as a manager, I'm going to be a better juggler.
I'm not sure about that, but we can run better software development projects.
Well, this is all kidding aside. This seems like it really will reduce the time that we spend making decisions on what's the next thing we do, right? I mean, we know what to test and can reduce the amount of testing we do. There's always that boundary between the developers and the testers where, you know, once a milestone is hit, like, a daily, that the testers will then go and force at it, right? But that's not really effective use of time if we only have to test part of the code, for example. So
right.
This sounds like fantastic stuff. Thank you, Andre. This has been very helpful, and I might even I might have to get a haircut. Maybe I can't have pointy hair as we move forward. So, team, thank you all that have endured our humor and have taken this journey with us in this three-part series. They are available for replay, so if you've missed MISRA or you missed 26262, you can get back to them through an easy Google search or looking in your email, as you may have gotten one from us or one from Open Systems Media. So we thank you for the time. I will tell you that as a part of the conclusion that we have for this third part in the series, we do have a promotion. That promotion is worthy. I'm not going to put a specific dollar amount to it, but I will tell you that if you reach out to us and you get a qualified demo of what you're going to need for your safety certification or any embedded project for that matter, and you mention this series, there is opportunity for you to get a very grand incentive to move forward with PERSOFT tools. Not only can we prove our value and back up the things that we've been talking about during this series, but we can also help you be effective at the amount of money that you may spend to get there, especially compared to our competition. So with that, Andre and I would like to thank you. Our contact information is here. You can reach out to us directly through email. You can also go to software@parasoft.com/embedded. There is it's kind of a microsite. It's kind of filtered down to some of the things that are specific about what we do. And in particular, it's got to get a demo for your environment where you can select some of the criteria for, you know, what operating system, what environment you might have for your compiler, your build tools, what versions of the tools that you're using. That helps us to get qualified so that we can give you an effective demo. So please go there, reach out to us, and if you're interested in learning more, be sure that you remember that we have a special promotion for those that have attended this series. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for your time. Hopefully this has been helpful in some context. I know that some of you have been asking questions, and we will stay online to answer them. And with that, I'd like to turn it back to Brandon. Thank you.
Thanks, David, and thank you as well, Andre. It's some really good information there about the SCLC and making sure you stay on track for certification. As David mentioned, that brings us to the Q&A portion of the event. So for those of you in the audience who have questions, please input them now, and we'll get to as many of them as we can in the time we have remaining, about 10 minutes left. So heading over to the questions, let's get started. The first one here, let's see, I'll pose this to David. It's a question here about using an older version of C++ test. Will the qualification kit work with that?
Oh, great question. So this actually is a somewhat common question related to the qualification kit, because the qualification kit is something that we produce. It is a supported product that we provide maintenance on, but it is specific to a tool chain. So when you think about what it takes to get safety certification, you're not only going to be dependent upon the precise version of our tool, but also all the other tools that are used, your compiler, and any of those that go into producing the code will be involved in this. So the rule of thumb is the qualification kit has to be designed for the version of the product that you're using. In the case of an older version, depending on how old it is, we do have earlier versions of our qualification kit. We have, quite frankly, been improving it as we've been moving forward. We see that qualification and that this, with all kinds of things like autonomous vehicle and all of the market indicators, that this will be something that will be more important moving forward. So we've been getting better and better at doing that. I would recommend that either you upgrade to the current release if possible, or talk up to us about what qualification kits we have to support the version that you may have. But a qualification kit is tied specifically to a version of our product.
That's great. All right, this one's for Andre. Can we integrate Jenkins workflow to check for compliance directly from the build system and fail build based on the policy?
Oh, yeah, it's actually a good question. I'm glad somebody picked up on that when I mentioned CI workflow. So yes, we have this the product called Policy Center, and you can aggregate multiple data points and create the policy workflows, and then from Jenkins, you basically will ask us, are we complying with this policy or not? And the Jenkins build, we have a Jenkins plugin that will check that, we call the quality gate, for either whether or not that quality gate pass fail, and then we'll continue the CI workflow based on that gate. So yes, absolutely.
Excellent. All right, reminder to the audience, keep your questions coming in, and we'll get to as many of them as we can in the time we have remaining. Here's one for you, David, and maybe actually I was thinking that managers might be really interested in this, but so may some of the line engineers. Does Parasoft provide services for the qualification process?
Yeah, this is another common question. So we, as I mentioned just a moment ago, the qualification kit for us is a supported product. So we will be able to support questions or even, you know, in the case of all of the artifacts that Andre covered, you know, it's possible that there is a defect, something that we had not covered in the qualification kit. And so support for getting that updated and supported for your certification process is there. But running the tool to on your assets to get the certification byproducts, right, the things that you have to submit, that's typically not what we do. We can be there for mentoring, and we can be there for training. We're typically not hired to actually turn the crank, if you will, to do the qualification. In any case, we can always talk about what's needed and work something out with the team. But in general, we're not there to support the labor effort.
Good stuff. Now back to you, Andre. I'm interested, the question says, I'm interested in your analytics engine, but concerned that it may be proprietary. Is there a way to use an API so I can get data in and out of the analytics engine?
Yeah, actually, it's another common question because we talked about some of the plugins that they have for open source tools. So you can go to marketplace.parasoft.com and see that just the amount of the open source tool integrations that we have. In addition to those integrations, we have a RESTful API that you can pull the data out or create some artifacts automatically. So yes, there are APIs, there are integrations. The system is open. We're not hiding the data. We're providing value on the top of the open source frameworks to aggregate the data and, again, be compliant with certain policies that you establish.
Great. And just to follow up on that, just to be clear, so if a third-party integration, Andre, makes an update of some kind, Does DTP automatically trigger a new test case and help you recertify, or is it just a notification, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a good question. So let's just take an example. If you use Google Test, for example, and you publish the results from your Google Test run along with the code coverage, and let's just make a hypothetical example that code coverage that you collected matters in your compliance. Let's just say that your compliance policy is to have 95% of the code covered. Whatever, I'm just making stuff up. But you get the idea. So the Google Test has nothing to do with Parsoft, right? But the data submitted by the Google Test with our plugin will be used to calculate the compliance, and then the dashboards will display the right data, and the quality gates will actually trigger the right process there to indicate whether or not you can pass the quality gate from a CI perspective.
Great. And then I guess another follow-up on that is, so you talked about some of the intelligent analytics and the intelligent tests. In the case of code coverage and just testing areas that have changed, how does that impact, possible dependencies on legacy code? Is it regenerating test vectors for any potentially affected code, or what happens there?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I was thinking about the same question when I looked at it. No, what happens is that we associate the test case with the coverage image. So we know for every single test case what are the lines, if you will, the lines of code that are covered in the code. So the next time, once the code changed, we know that which lines of code are going to be affected by that test. So we record quite a bit of information to give you that analytics.
That's great. Back to you, David. I don't want to leave you out in the cold here. It seems like DTP does a lot for reporting and policy enforcement, but is it expensive? This is the baseline question that always comes up. Budget next year is already set. How much does it cost?
Thank you. So, I would start with none of our tools are expensive, Brandon, of course.
Right.
They are worth every penny at the value that they offer. I will say that uniquely qualified for DTP is a tremendous value. It is one of the most cost-effective tools in our product line, because it supports all of our products, but it supports a lot of open source and has the built-in integrations with things like Jenkins and Jira that we just spoke about. Not to get into something very specific, because an instance would always vary. But, at less than $300 per person, DTP can be deployed on even a smaller product. So it is a very cost-advantageous product. We probably could charge more for it, and if anybody's willing to pay more, I'm happy to charge them. But, it's a common question. We do try to put DTP into all of our sales opportunities for the most part, not because we're going to make a lot of money on it, but because the value that's presented to the customer is extremely high. So
that's great. Got time for one more here, and I'll pose it to Andre. So you were showing the compliance dashboard a while ago with some of the violations that came up. Do you have the ability to modify that based on your particular system design to look at specific types of violations, et cetera?
In short, the answer is yes. So I'll give you a little bit more detailed answer. We only have 1 minute left. We can slice and dice the problem in many pieces. Right, we can look at your standard, what is the policy that you want to enforce, and then help you create custom widgets. We can also help you create custom policies that will be automatically enforced with the CI workflow. We can break the system down to components and track the violations or the data, the code coverage, the complexity by those common resources. So there are multiple ways to slice and dice this gap here.
Great. All right. Well, great presentation today. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time. For those of you who had questions we weren't able to get to in this hour, we'll be sure to have the appropriate Parasoft representatives follow up with you. I'd like to thank David Hauck and Andre Madan of Parasoft for helping us navigate some of the intricacies of the software development lifecycle today and the certification, as well as their insights over the past two sessions as well. Don't forget that there is a discount if you mention this series when you contact Parasoft. We would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing some great questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search for the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCast archived there as MP3s. Thanks again for attending, and have a great day.